Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host for this program. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone from the literary world. My guest today is Steve Jaddick, who has just published a fascinating book, How's My Driving? Steve, welcome to the program. It is great to talk to you.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Maybe we can start with a little background. Who is Steve Jaddick?
Okay, well, I could go on and on, but the kind of a thumbnail sketch, I guess, would be someone who spent 18 years of his life growing up in a little town in Oregon. And then I went into the Navy, spent 8 years in the Navy where I met the love of my life. We've been married for almost 44 years now.
Wow.
Yeah. And in fact, next month is going to be our 44th anniversary. And then while I was in the Navy, I got exposed to the nuclear power aspects of it, nuclear submarines, and when I got out of there, I went into commercial nuclear power generation, and I spent a good deal of my life operating a commercial nuclear power plant and then training the operators to do it. And about 2000 or 2001, we moved down to Florida, and we have really had our life change. I took a complete 180-degree turn and went into the insurance industry, and I've spent the last, 7 years or so as a property and casualty insurance agent, and that's been very, very eye-opening for me.
I'll bet. your name, your surname, It's D-Z-I-A-D-I-K,
yes.
Jaddick?
Yes, sir.
Is it an Eastern European name?
Well, my father told me it's Ukrainian or White Russian, and I stored that piece of information, but I always said, when everybody asked me about it, I just said, I'm from Oregon, so I don't really understand. I've never been there, so I wouldn't honestly know what it would make a difference. I'm also told that in Polish, the name actually means grandfather or old man, so I finally arrived.
You know, I could probably discover where it's from. For a period of time, I lived in Alberta, Calgary. Sorry, Alberta, Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And that there is a small Ukrainian town about 100 miles or so from Calgary. And its claim to fame is the world's largest egg. And it's one of those delightful decorated eggs.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And the thing is on a large podium. And the town is very Ukrainian. For some reason, all of the Ukrainian immigrants drifted there. I'm sure there might be some Jaddicks around that area.
I'm sure too. It's a relatively unique name. You don't find it a lot in the phone books.
Indeed. How about giving us a quick summary about How's My Driving?
Okay. Well, How's My Driving? Being a writer of a book is not something I ever imagined myself doing. As I would think, probably most people that do wind up writing their first one feel. This came out sort of out of a challenge. I worked with a guy in the insurance industry, and we've heard over the years a number of, ridiculous to the sublime as far as experiences that people have had on the roads and what they did and didn't have for insurance as a result of that. And I kind of, I cataloged all of those kind of in my brain. And I'm also probably one of the world's best advocates of driving safely, and I think I'm the only person that knows how to do it. So So I always used to tell everybody else through my windshield how to drive their cars. And this particular young man that I was working with said, you know, you ought to write a book. And so I said, yeah, right. And so one thing led to another, and I went home and I wrote up three pages. I said, oh, there's no sense wasting my time if it's not going to be worthwhile, if nobody will even read it. So I brought it back to him, and he read it, and he said, hey, that's pretty good. And there was an 18-year-old girl there, and she read it, and she also said the same thing. She thought that it kept her interest. She was curious about what more I might have to say. And then it just kind of evolved from that point. In the very first page of the book, there's something called Steve's Theorems.
Yes, indeed.
And I don't know if I know people that have done mathematical problems are familiar with what theorems are, but these are kind of like my little idiosyncrasies that say about people in general and how they approach life, at least as based on my observations and my beliefs. If you'll notice each one of them, if you take the time to read it, each one of them starts out with I believe.
Right.
It's me. But when I did that, I did it so I could refer back to them throughout the book rather than continually say everything over and over again. And my goal was, there's really four of them in there, was to try and somehow have people not have an accident, because my wife and I, 40 years ago right now today, we're actually still in the hospital from a almost life-ending accident, and we lost a child in that accident. And the baby wasn't born yet, but she was 6 months along, and that was a traumatic experience, and I wanted to share that. And she did too. And then, as unfortunate would have it, I wound up having another major car accident, and that's the last of them. That one's on the front of the book.
So, yes, I was going to mention that. I mean, the cover art is really quite horrific.
Mm-hmm.
And well, you know, that could well have been a life-ending situation.
Oh, no argument. In all likelihood, it should have been, because none of us were wearing seatbelts. We didn't have airbags. And we're doing about, I don't know, 50, 55 miles an hour on a unlit road. And all of a sudden, I turned around, talking to a guy. I turned around, and there was a Ford Bronco in front of me about 30 or 40 feet away. And you get time to say, oh. And that's all I got out.
You didn't even get the expletive out.
No, I didn't. I only got to say one word, and the next thing I knew, I was laying on the pavement face down.
Oh.
So I what I did is I figured I actually wanted to talk to young people, because there's so many young drivers out there that they get in the car and they drive for a week, and they think they've got it all handled. You can do this. There's nothing to it. And they start with cell phones, and they start with other kids, and they start with texting, and they start with all of those things, and they don't understand that it takes years of experience to even be remotely safe, and,
mm-hmm.
and ultimately you never make it. You just do the best you can from one day to the next in the car.
Almost a decade, I lived in the San Diego area, and my work actually took me to L.A. so many times that I reached the stage where I knew the city so well I didn't even need a map.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I didn't think that would ever occur. You know, and you'd be going along the freeway, bumper to bumper, at what seemed like 150 miles an hour, and you know the woman in front would be applying her makeup.
That's incredible.
Oh, it just used to scare the living daylights out of me.
Absolutely, yeah. Oh, and I made the theorems kind of the way they came to me. And the first one I put down, I mean, obviously, and I say it in the book, that any one of them could be more important than the other. So it's not, number one isn't number one all the time. But to me, I thought that the first thing that came to me is I don't believe that people get up in the morning, go through all of whatever rituals they have, get and wind up, I think I just got a phone call coming in, and wind up trying to do the worst job they can do at driving. They don't do that.
Well, actually, one of the things that amazes me is that I know all of these really nice people. You know, they're wonderful people. You invite them to your home for dinner. You know, you meet them at parties and other gatherings. You know, that they're absolutely the best folks in the entire universe. Until they get behind the wheel of a car.
Yep.
And, you know, suddenly an entirely different personality comes out. And they're now monsters.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, when you said that, it made me think of one of my theorems again. Number 9 says, I believe that discourteous behavior to other drivers on the roadway is not the result of an absence or lack of courtesy. I believe it is an overt action that a person takes based on a variety of reasons, not the least of which is to believe that your actions on the road must come before the actions of any other driver. And you're right. And everybody wants to get there first.
Indeed.
And they do turn into monsters sometimes.
Yes. I've seen it so many times. I just close my eyes and go, oh, you know, please, just let me live through this.
Amen to that. If you look at the dedication, I actually only had one originally because I wound up putting a second one in there, though, but the dedication is to my wife.
Mm-hmm.
Because unfortunately, most of the oral discussions that I had with people, they never heard a word of it. Only my wife did. She happened to be trapped in the car with me. And
right.
So, you know, over the years, she got to listen to all of that stuff. The other one wound up being that the little girl that we never got to meet, you know, we get to put closure on losing her because she's now been documented and she now gives us a reason to go talk to teenagers. So that's, you know, it's not nice to lose a child, I guarantee you, but when you can see something positive as a result of it, I hope that that she can see it as well.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment. You go to, is it schools or groups?
Yep. As a matter of fact, next week I'm going to one of the local high schools here, and they've got a couple of different classes that they found this seems to apply to. There's something called a HOPE class, which is Health Options from Physical Education, I think is what HOPE stands for. And I did one of these for a church, and somebody heard about it, and then I wound up in a high school, and I did it for the HOPE class, and now they all want it to be a part of what they do. The idea being that I go in, and I have about a 45 minute just talk, and I have a PowerPoint presentation. The picture that you saw on the front of the book is a part of it. I thought I was going to write the book so that I'd have author credentials to stand up in front of these kids, but the reality is it seems that the accidents that I had gives me more speaking authority than anything. What they do is I go over them and I say, listen, here's what happened to me, and I explain it in as quick a detail but also as painful a detail as I can. The explanations in the book are much more in-depth, but I don't have that time in front of them. And then I use some local teen deaths, unfortunately, to drive the point home.
Yeah. The world of driving has changed a great deal in the past 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
You started driving at the grand old age of 7.
Yep.
I doubt that you would advocate that parents today encourage this habit.
Oh, not at all. Of course, things were substantially different then. You know, and I didn't drive out on the road. I mean, if I got to the paved portion of the road only to cross it and park at the mailbox. But my job was to go get the Sunday paper. And my father let me drive, and I looked right through the steering wheel. I sat on the seat and looked through the steering wheel spokes and drove his, his 1951 GMC pickup truck with a four-speed manual transmission in it. Never got it out of second. My mother hated it.
Right, I'll bet.
She did.
You're working with children. How important is driver's ed?
Oh, I think it's incredibly important. And you know what's really a sort of a shame is, at least what I'm seeing locally here, and I don't know if this is true across the United States, but maybe this is just a microcosm, that they seem to be cutting back on it. The driver's education classes are available, but where they used to be part of the whole curriculum, in a lot of cases now what they're doing is they're making it they're making it mandatory, but they're doing it in like a six-hour class. And I'll be honest with you, I don't think that's nearly enough time to demonstrate to these kids the situations that they could find themselves in.
You know, this is sort of off-topic, yet not. I have read and interviewed a couple of authors recently that have written books about education. Mm-hmm. And everyone thought that the No Child Left Behind initiative was a great idea at the time. However, when you actually look at what's happened in the school system, you find that in many ways it's backfired. The impetus has become, you know, math, English, and don't get me wrong here, these are incredibly important, but it's become results oriented.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to have the children pass the acid tests.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're losing is a lot of the courses that create better people. You know, driver's education is one of them.
And I think that part of the thing that goes out of that, especially just talking about driving, part of my presentation is I ask kids to define what an accident is. And it's amazing what you'll hear. I mean, the fender benders, and you ran into somebody and you didn't mean to, and this, that, and the other. And I tell them, I say, you know what accident means? If you look it up in the dictionary, it literally means something that's occurred that really there's no apparent reason for. And so I set them up in a scenario where I'm driving down the road at 40 miles an hour, and I pick out one of the kids in the front row and say, you're right behind me in your car, and you're back the appropriate distance, and a mouse runs across the road in front of me. And I don't want to kill the little mouse, so I lock up my brakes. I stand on my brakes, screech to a stop, and save the mouse's life, and you run into me. Is that an accident? And invariably, I get all head shakes in the yes direction. Once in a while, you know, one or two of them will pick up on it right away and realize that, no, it's not. It's not an accident. And I turn around and I say, who's going to get the ticket? And as it turns out, almost all the time, the person that hits from the rear is. And there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
And I to ask one of them to take out their driver's license and say, you know what that card stands for? It stands for a promise from you to everybody else that 24/7 you're going to operate your vehicle under your control all the time, and regardless of what happens in front of you, you won't let it have an impact on anybody else. And they can't argue with that. But that's not being driven home to them.
Right. I grew up in England. You might have figured that out from my accent. You're right. It's not really much of a Mississippian accent. And in England, they have an interesting system. If you're learning to drive, you have your learner's permit. Not only must you have a qualified driver in the front seat of the car with you, you also have to have what is known as L plates on the vehicle. Essentially, it's a white square with a large red L in it. Mm-hmm. And this lets other motorists know that the person operating the vehicle is just learning. And, you know, essentially you should act accordingly. You know, give them some space. You know, don't abuse them. You know, everyone has to learn.
Right.
Would this be useful here in the U.S.?
Well, certainly anything that would help people. I mean, it's like using your turn signals. I talk to the kids and I say, listen, use your turn signals. And I said, here's the reason. There's two reasons. One, you paid for them when you bought the car. So to not use them is not real smart. But the second thing is if I'm coming at you and you're coming at me and you got your turn signals on, I have a better chance of knowing what you're going to do than trying to read which way your car turns or what you're thinking. And anything that would make it easier for the other people to know, like the L plates, that, I think it's a great idea. But, you know, again, it still comes down to how people deal with it, because did you ever see anybody pass a person that says it's in a student driver car and cut them off?
Oh, yeah. All the time.
So, it's really a function of the other people being courteous.
I believe it's Australia. Not only did they require the infamous L plates, but for a one-year period after obtaining a full driver's license, you have to have what's called a P plate, which is a white square with a large, I think it's a blue P on it, which says, I've passed, but I'm still potentially dangerous.
Again, anything that would alert other people to the condition of the driver. I mean, because, you know, all drivers are not created equal. When I see a driver, and this has nothing to do with how I feel about people's age or anything, but when I see a person get into a car in with a walker, and that could be a 30-year-old person, I wonder, and they're driving the car, I wonder how they're going to be able to react to the gas pedal and the brake pedal in the event of an emergency. You know, how good can their controls be if they need aids just to walk on the ground? So anything that would alert me to their conditions would make it much better for me, I would think.
One aspect of how's my driving that I found most illuminating are the couple of chapters that you dedicate to the subject of insurance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people tend to just view it as this necessary and ugly evil, and the object of the exercise is to find the absolute cheapest you can,
mm-hmm.
without actually understanding what they are buying. What do people need to understand about insurance?
Well, I think the first thing that people need to understand is what it is. I mean, it's not a necessary evil. If you look at it that way, I don't care what it costs you, you're going to assume that it's wasted money. The most important realization is that what you're paying for when you buy insurance is to transfer the risk of you having an event occur in your life that's going to cost a significant amount of money. You're going to transfer that risk away from you, and you're doing it for some amount of money. Insurance companies pick that risk up, and they cover you in a pooled coverage arena. I mean, they take everybody's money, and then when somebody messes up, everybody's money pays for that one person. Now, the most important thing, though, is that you can't reduce, and I can't say this loudly enough, you cannot reduce your premium and not sacrifice your coverage. That when you look at the commercials on TV now, you get the impression that people can walk in and You name your own price, and we'll give you the coverage you need.
Yes, yeah, I love that advert. I mean, it's completely false, but
the base assumption is that people know what their coverage does for them, and from my experience in the industry, most people don't. In fact, I had so many people over the years that called me up, and the first thing they wanted to do was, I'm paying too much. Okay, great, I'm here to help. And I say, what we can do is we'll make sure that what you've got fits you. Do you know what bodily injury means? Well, you know, I said, but what does full coverage mean? You know, and you get all these answers back. Well, invariably, in almost every case, when I broke it down for them, explained to them what their coverages did for them, how it protected their assets, how it protected their homes, the roof over their head, their families, nest egg, whatever, invariably, they wound up spending more money afterwards because they realized that their coverage wasn't where it should be. And they did it cheerfully. And I feel good about it. I mean, I lowered them. There's no doubt about that. But the real thing is that were they properly covered? I had a guy come in. I got to tell you this one. I had a guy come in one time, and he had liability coverage of 10-20, which is 10,000 per person or 20,000 per accident. And he wanted to lower his premium. Come to find out, the guy had a net worth of a little over $7 million. And I said, you realize that if you get into an accident, if you run over somebody's kid, that you could lose all that money? And he looked at me, and he didn't know it. He did not know it. So guess what he didn't leave without? Lots of insurance. And I didn't have to, I did not know when I started talking to him that he was in that shape. I mean, I would never, you looked at this guy, you would have never figured he was worth $7 million. Not that there's a particular way that a person looks, but clearly I didn't think he was very rich.
Right. So, I mean, what you're essentially saying is that it's horses for courses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to understand what you're buying and put it into the context of your personal situation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And the thing of it is that if people are blessed and their life is rewarded with lots of things and their net worth goes up, they need to constantly reappraise where they're at insurance-wise. Because your agent has no way of knowing that you now have more assets to cover. And I said in the book, I think that you should be reviewed at least yearly. Sit down and talk with them. Your premium pays for that. It's not any extra cost. Talk it over.
A real gray area, and one that I'll admit to having absolutely no understanding of, every time I get involved in a conversation about it, I hear conflicting information. The whole question about what to do when you rent a car. Mm-hmm. You know, should you take out the extra insurance or not?
Okay. And I hear that all the time, too. It's amazing, again, going back to looking at your own policy, of what people don't understand that their coverage covers them for. Basically, when you buy insurance, they are insuring your vehicle. If you've got a 75 Ford, they're insuring that vehicle. But the real thing that they're insuring is they're insuring you because you are the risk. The vehicle can't have an accident by itself. So when you purchase insurance and coverage that protects you from losses that might be your fault, where they could come after your assets, that coverage pretty much goes with you everywhere. And so if you go to, for instance, your bodily injury protection and your typically your collision and comprehensive and all of those things, they go with you wherever you go. If you jump in somebody else's car, typically what happens is their insurance transfers with you, because you just gave them permission to operate your vehicle. It's as if you are. And the only problem is that when you do that, then if they have an accident, guess who gets credit for it?
Right.
Well, and that goes, unfortunately, people don't know that. You know, I don't think you have to worry if they commit vehicular homicide that that's going to be transferred. I mean, obviously, there's a line in the sand.
Mm-hmm.
But with rental cars, that is a question that comes up. Your insurance more than likely, and I'm going to qualify this just a little bit and say always check with your insurance agent. But more than likely, they're going to tell you that your insurance goes with you on that rental car. The problem is not whether or not you have the insurance. The problem is if you ever need to use it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you get into an accident in a rental car company's car, they're going to do something that your insurance company is never going to pay for. They're going to want to be reimbursed for the loss of their vehicle's time to be rented. And that could be significant. Your insurance company will never pay for that,
right,
more than likely. The other thing is if you use your own insurance, then you're going to have to be the go-between between getting that car fixed and your insurance company. It's going to be much more difficult. My very short, simple answer for anybody is buy the insurance, because when you get done, you give them the key back, regardless of the shape of the car, you walk away. That's why you bought the insurance. I know it sounds like I'm saying spend extra money, but if you're the kind of a person that doesn't mind doing detailed, painful, boring, incredibly difficult work and paperwork, then use your own insurance. Save $15. I mean, you know, but honestly, my recommendation is buy the insurance, because you're saying basically, when I get done with this car, you're going to take it back and you're not going to bug me anymore, because my insurance that you're giving me takes care of it.
Right.
And you get the key back and you're gone.
Do you have a website?
Yes, sir, I do. It's www.house-my-driving.com, just like the book's name is, without the question mark or the apostrophe.
And where can people buy copies?
Well, Amazon.com is probably the quickest and easiest way to do it. BarnesandNoble.com also is carrying it. I've been looking at some of the sites, and you can order it through any of the local bookstores. I was watching when the thing first started becoming for sale, and it's my first book. I started to look at where it was being marketed at, and I saw it was being marketed in the UK. I'm going, oh, my goodness, I feel...
Yeah, they drive on the wrong side of the road anyway.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, it's available basically anywhere that you can buy a regular book. It's specifically categorized as education/driver education, because that's really, you know, you try to put your finger and say, what is it really about? And that's really what it's about. Although, as I say in the book, and I'll be honest with you, Simon, I can't drive safely for you. Only you can drive safely for you.
Right. You mentioned that this was your first foray into the world of writing.
Mm-hmm.
I want to ask you how you enjoyed the process. I get to talk to many, many new authors, and most have this huge level of frustration. They thought writing the book was hard.
Mm-hmm.
Then they discover that publishing the book is even harder. And then they have to deal with the dreaded M word,
yep.
Marketing.
Marketing.
Yeah, what's your view? Did you have a good time?
Well, I look back on it and I say, a year ago I hadn't even considered doing this book. So it all happened pretty fast, really. When I talk to people that have done it, you know, there are people saying they've taken 3 or 4 years to write a book. For whatever reason, the people on the local highways gave me so much material that I didn't really have to look very far, because every day I got a new experience, and I just basically wrote them down. But writing it was pretty much, I just felt motivated and driven to do it. I spent all my spare time, and I did it in probably about 3, maybe 4 months. But then came getting it to the present condition that it's in. That was fun. And I'm being a little tongue-in-cheek when I say that. I got this company, Outskirts Press, did a very good job. I'm really pleased in the product, the final product. I never expected to be holding in my hands what I've got. And there were times when I was wondering if it was even worth it. But one of the marketers there told me something very interesting. They say that if you look at 100% as the number that you would apply to the complete aspect of a book, from thinking about it to having it a New York Times bestseller, if that's the end, there's 10% of your effort goes into literally writing the book.
Yeah.
30% goes from that point getting it to where it's at right now. And that's true. And that was a painful 30%. I mean, you really have to, unless you got tons of money. If you got tons of money, then it's a piece of cake. They'll do it all for you. There are turnkey book places, but the one that I went through wasn't. I had to do most of the work. It was still a learning experience, though, and it was a good one. And now I'm into that 60% of the M word.
the dreaded M word. The
dreaded M word.
Are you doing book signings or anything like that?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I am. I've got a couple of bookstores around here that I'm still pretty much local right now. I take my little pile of books and I go to, and I've actually gone to flea markets, and you get people walking by and they look at it, I always thought that a cover wouldn't sell a book, but I kind of think that this accident, my car on the front there, when they see that and they ask me, "That's you?" It makes them kind of want to pick it up and buy it.
A story that I use, I've used on a number of occasions, is one of my favorite sayings that my mother had as I was growing up: "Never judge a book by its cover." Mm-hmm. Now, I actually disagree with her. I understand what she was saying, mm-hmm. but a book's cover does actually say a lot about the book. Mm-hmm. In fact, as a reviewer, I look at the cover, front cover, back cover, and I'm one of those strange people that actually read the pages that no one else does.
Somebody had to read them.
Well, yeah, and I guess they designed them just for me. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, without reading a line of text, you can discover quite a lot.
mm-hmm. Yep.
And I think you chose well with your cover art. I think it genuinely gets the message across.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems it.
What sort of reader feedback are you getting?
I'm getting actually very good feedback. And we're, like I said, we're still sort of in our infancy, but the people that are reading it are saying, I had a teenage girl, as a matter of fact, and it goes back to I said that there was a young girl that read the first 3 pages.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she said she waited until it was all done and she read the book, and she said, she asked me beforehand. She said, "What's your goal?" And I said, "Well, you know, my goal is the number one goal of the book. It's to prevent some person." One person at least, after they read it, they'll change their life and they won't have at least one accident. Well, that's not very, it's not easy to measure. But she said something to me that really made me feel good. After she got done reading it, she said, "If nobody else buys the book, you accomplished your goal." And I went, "Wow, that's pretty powerful."
A section in your book that I read with, I have to admit, huge amusement. You know, even though your subject matter is, deathly serious.
Yep.
And it concerns all of the gadgets, gizmos, and overall complexity involved in today's motor vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a product of consumer desire, or are the manufacturers trying to create the need? I absolutely need a DVD player. I absolutely need a GPS system.
Well, I guess the answer to that question is, you know, honestly answered by them. But my feeling is that they are doing that. The mileage on my 2008 car that I have right now is roughly the same as the first car that I ever got, which was a 1949 Ford. And clearly, today's vehicle is supposed to be superior to that, motor-wise. But the thing of it is that I think they do keep adding things on to keep consumer interest up, because they want to move cars, and stuff moves cars.
I view it as the steak and sizzle deal. You know, they're selling the sizzle rather than the steak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the basic mode of transportation, I mean, the wheel hasn't really changed much. It's just it's the number of things that you hang off of it.
Actually, the problem I have, I have a 19-year-old stepson,
mm-hmm.
and he doesn't know very much about cars. I believe his is something like 7 or 8 years old. It's a nice little thing, you know, nothing wrong with it, until there's something wrong with it. And, you know, you look under the hood and you go, I have no clue what any of this is.
Absolutely. Yeah, you used to be able to, I think you used to be able to gap points with a matchbook cover, and, I mean, it's just, you know, you'd look at people now and say, what are points?
Right.
It's amazing. I mean, it's incredible. I just recently had a problem with a car that got fixed last week, and I took it back to the manufacturer, and they changed several items on it, telling me that was going to fix the car. And when it didn't, they didn't give me my money back. They said, "Well, we're going to try something else." And I said, "Hold it." Are you guys doing this scientifically, or are you Easter egging it? And the guy said, "Well, you know, it's very difficult to troubleshoot these cars." And I said, "That's precisely the reason why I brought it back to you, because you guys make it." And I didn't take it to Jack's service station down at the end of the street. But, you know, I didn't think that was a good answer.
No, I think it's a very poor answer.
Mm-hmm.
I lost
a lot of money.
Right. Oops. I hear my producer nagging at me.
Okay.
Gonna have to wrap this up. But that was her nagging at me again. I really, really want to thank you for taking time to talk to me today, and I do hope that everything works well with How's My Driving.
Simon, I thank you so very much for taking the time to spend with me too, and I hope that I hope the book does save at least one life. And unfortunately, I don't think we'll ever really know that for sure, but we only know about the 40,000 that are lost every year. So thank you very much for the time.
Steve, it's been great talking to you. This is Simon Barrett for Blogger News Network, wishing everyone a great and safe Friday. And we will all be talking again soon. Goodbye.
Goodbye.